Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, there is a very rare condition in which children don't age at a normal rate. In fact, in many respects, they hardly seem to age at all and might appear to be toddlers when they're actually in their 20s. I saw a program on the TLC cable channel called My 40-Year-Old Child about this condition, and on the doctor who's a world expert on it and actually the first to recognize the condition. His name is Dr. Richard Walker. Although he's not actually a medical doctor, he's an endocrinologist. He has held faculty positions in the medical schools at the Universities of Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and South Florida. And a while back, he founded the Journal of Clinical Interventions in Aging, where he's now editor-in-chief. But he's still actively pursuing research on this highly unusual condition with real patients from around the world. And that's why we have him on as a guest. Welcome, Dr. Walker.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Can we call you Rich?
Please.
Why don't you start by just telling us something about this very rare condition?
I became aware of this in 2008 when NBC Dateline had a program called, The Girl Who Doesn't Age. This caught my attention because my whole career has been focused on trying to understand the reason for our mortality, if you will, the reason we actually continue to age beyond development. So when I saw this girl who was presented there at 13 looking like a two-month-old girl, it fit into my hypothesis that aging is a consequence of development continuing beyond young adulthood, so that as you continue to change, when change is no longer necessary, we slowly go into a state of chaos or, you know, disorganization, and that is the main factor. So now this girl showing or appearing to be slowed in aging suggested to me that this might be a good place to study my hypothesis, because if there is a genetic mechanism that regulates the rate of our development and aging, then if we could find that gene and manipulate it, then we should be able to manipulate the aging process as well.
Well, let's talk more about the genetics of it a little later, and I'm sure they're complicated. I doubt it's one gene, right? But I mean, I'm wondering about its name. I've heard it referred to as Syndrome X and also as Benjamin Button children, but I don't think either one of those are right. What do you think about
they're
that?
They're not, and I can give you a brief history on that. The proband, or the first subject, was being treated by Dr. Larry Pakula in Baltimore, and he could not diagnose the syndrome. He hadn't seen anything like it, and so he just arbitrarily called it Syndrome X. Well, of course, there are Syndrome X's. Syndrome X is a metabolic syndrome. But he just meant it in the sense of being X. I don't know what it is. In my subsequent research on the topic, I found that there are several children who could go undiagnosed and were referred to simply as Syndrome X. It has nothing to do with the metabolic syndrome, though.
So what are its characteristics? You mentioned, you know, being very young looking like a 2 month old when you're 13, but the ones I saw on the TV show had a variety of characteristics, so why don't you kind of enumerate those?
The most striking one is this retention of juvenile characteristics and a very slow rate of development. So the physical appearance and characteristics of the body are those of youth, and I do have some subjects who are in their 20s. They have not reached normal markers of development. In other words, they still have baby teeth, they haven't developed axillary hair or pubic hair, and they were all girls, by the way, that we found. There's no boys have been found with this syndrome. So they have characteristics of youth, even though they are well beyond into their young adulthood. In addition to that, they have secondary characteristics that are typical, primarily gastrointestinal problems. They have a very poor peristalsis, so they have constipation, they have reflux, esophageal reflux, and many of them can't suck. So as children, they have to be fed with a gastric tube. They have to be given supplemental nutrition. The interesting thing about these children, though, is as much calories as you give them will not stimulate their growth, so their condition is not nutritional deprivation. As a matter of fact, many of these, if not all of them, have also been given growth hormone to try to stimulate their growth, and that doesn't work either. So clearly, their bodies are unresponsive or unprepared to go beyond the point of development at which, or the rate at which they're naturally proceeding. In addition to this, they all have poor neural development, not anatomically necessarily, although we do find some brain structural defects, but they have poor cognitive development, many of them not exceeding 2 or 3 years at most. They tend to have seizures. They also have an unusual characteristic of skeletal system problems, specifically with their legs and feet. The first child that we found had dislocated hips, thought it was irrelevant, but subsequently have found that it occurs in other girls that have the syndrome. There is, in some cases, heart problems, although this is not in every case. But in most cases, there are breathing problems, and as a matter of fact, in the first subject who we studied, she passed at 22. She died at 22 due to tracheomalacia. The development of her breathing tubes was such that she couldn't continue to breathe. She got pneumonia and died. So these characteristics, some heart defects, definitely gastrointestinal effects, some cardiac, definitely neural, but primarily associated with the features, there are dysmorphic features. So if you look at the face, while they appear to be children and young, you can see that there's some distortion of proportion. They tend to have their ears somewhat offset, and their fingers are sometimes fused. Dysmorphic features are characteristic, but the primary recognizing characteristic are two, one being the appearance of youth, the retention of youthful development, in other words, the never reaching the appropriate developmental points, and then also this characteristic gastrointestinal problem. Every single patient that we studied has the same gastrointestinal problem.
Okay, so they, apart from being very small, also the ones I saw on the show were all blind, I believe. Is that...
No, that's not true. They're not all blind,
okay.
But blindness has occurred, and this is because, in some cases, the cortical development in the back of the brain is not complete, so they have cortical blindness. They're not actually blind as a result of something being the matter with their eyes, but this is not universal.
Okay, so this is far from being as clean a situation as just a child who ages very slowly. They also have a wide range of physical and even mental or neurological disabilities, as you described. So,
yes, that's true, and that's one of the problems in us making a diagnosis regarding the aging characteristic, because we've got to tease apart all the genes that may be associated with these secondary clinical characteristics.
Well, you mentioned the one individual who died in her 20s, I think, but do you know enough about them as far as having experience with a large enough group to know if they have anything like a normal lifespan? I mean, it's not like they're living to be 200 because their aging is slowed,
well,
right?
This is conjecture purely, but because of the rate of development, which is slow, we've actually measured that, and in my first paper published the rate of development. If there were no secondary risks, you would have to assume that if the hypothesis is right, that development is related to aging, then a slow development would logically lead to an extended lifespan. But, of course, we can't test that until we can tease apart aging from the other clinical
debilities
that are life-threatening. It's hard to answer that question without having a pure mutation affecting only the rate of development, which we're looking for now.
Do you have any idea how many individuals around the world, even if you extrapolate statistically or whatever, there might be with this condition at any given time?
Well, when we first discovered this and reported on Good Morning America and some of the other places, I was asked that question, and because I had no experience and the condition hadn't had much publicity, I said, no, I can't imagine this has happened very often. But I was wrong, because following some of the broadcasts early on, and then the TLC show that you mentioned, actually there was one before it as well, people have been contacting me to determine if their girls or children have this syndrome. And in fact, I get many calls, many of whom are not syndrome X, because we can explain their developmental delay by endocrine problems or some other issues that are easily explained. But right now, out of the number that we've found, in the United States, we have 7 families that I feel are, in fact, good representatives of the syndrome. I have also received calls from countries like Estonia, from Brazil, from China, actually, and from other countries report having these types of children. The issues with them is that we have difficulty in getting valid medical records on their histories, on obviously on examining the children, and of course on getting the families together to get the DNA. Because when we do DNA analysis, we do it not only on the subject, but we do it on the parents and siblings as well to determine if this is an inherited characteristic or spontaneous, a de novo mutation. There are a lot more of these cases than we even represent now. I can't put a number on it, but if you would imagine that these children need lots of care in places that poor countries, third world countries, they probably die quite early. They die maybe at birth,
right,
or maybe even in utero, because a lot of times these children have poor development, in uterine growth retardation. So I would expect that the number is larger, way larger than we see in clinic.
Yeah, I would think even apart from the relatively constrained reporting you get from around the world outside the U.S., there are many places where it doesn't get reported at all because, as you say, they can't even feed themselves, they can't even nurse,
And not only that, the local doctors wouldn't report it anyway. It's just undiagnosed, and if you don't have large medical centers or anything, like NIH or someplace where you could send these cases, they're not even diagnosed.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Richard Walker, who is a researcher, an expert on a certain very rare condition in children that goes by various kind of inaccurate or invalid names, but I think he's going to be the one to officially name it. But it's a condition in which essentially children age very slowly, but in conjunction with a number of other disabilities that go along with this condition that complicate the diagnosis and maybe possible treatment of it. But do we know, it sounds like you're pretty convinced that it's genetic in nature, but do we know what causes that? Is it some environmental cause behind the genetic misfiring, let's call it, or is it, do you see any repeated occurrence of it in families, or what do you think causes that?
Well, I've been fortunate to have the collaboration of colleagues in a company called Complete Genomics in California that have been very generous with their resources to do genome sequencing on each of the children and their families. So we are developing a library of mutations, genetic information on these children and their families. I was hoping actually to find few genes that actually regulated the rate of change or rate of development, but in fact, in these girls, we found that there are quite a few. Many of them are located on the X chromosome, which may account for the fact that there are no boys having the syndrome. But with regard to your question of inheritance, we find that these are not associated with any kind of genetic linkage to family. They seem to be spontaneous mutations that occur in the children for some unknown reason. Now you say environmental, I don't really know, but there doesn't seem to be any type of environmental linkage between the subjects that we are now studying. They are in the majority from the United States and Canada. They all are from middle-income and upper-income families, and they seem to be from a healthy group of people, so we can't really put it, at least obviously, on some sort of maladaptive environment. Could it be secondary to mutation? I have a colleague by the name of Steve Horvath who's working at USA looking at what is called epigenetics or, other factors, metabolic factors that may modify the expression of genes. And one of the things that he's looking at is DNA methylation. It's a chemical transformation of the gene associated with aging. So we haven't found anything there yet, except for the fact that in tissues of these girls that we've taken, and it's only been blood so far, the blood of the girls appears to be the same chronological age, same as their chronological age. In other words, while their clinical characteristics, their whole body characteristics, look young, their blood, at least, appears to be their appropriate age. So if the girl is 2 years old and she's 15, the blood seems to be 15 years old. So we're in conflict now as to whether this epigenetic measure represents only a tissue or if it can be representative of the whole organism. Where we are there, we're trying to work that out because Steve knows already from his past history of studying other subjects that in one individual, for example, you might have a DNA age of the blood that's different from a DNA age of the liver. So we're not sure those data really can tell us much about how old these girls are biologically. But what we are doing is testing not only mutational effects that may be causal in this phenomenon, but also epigenetic. And so in answer to your question, and I guess that was a circuitous answer, yes, we're doing both, and no, it doesn't seem at this point to be an inherited issue.
Let me kind of switch gears to your focus then. What is the purpose of your research? Do you hope to find a treatment for this very rare condition that's so elusive already?
No. When you introduced me, you pointed out the fact that I was a scientist, not a medical doctor. And my whole career has been devoted to an understanding of a significant biological issue, and that is aging. And as a matter of fact, when I started studying this in the 60s, in late 60s and 70s, they were just starting a scientific interest in aging. As a matter of fact, the National Institute on Aging was only founded in 1972. So I've been interested in this process now for as long as I've been an academic. So my concern is, if I were able to understand the regulation of development and aging, then we've come a long way, not only in biology, but also in medicine, because if we have age-related and time-related diseases, like say some cancers or Alzheimer's disease or some of these other things, where we could in some way slow the rate of change, slow the rate of aging, then the period of treatment of these diseases would be extended. So in fact, there are huge practical ramifications to the study of aging. And when I started, in the 70s, I knew everyone in the field. Now, the importance of aging to medicine is so significant that there are thousands of people in the field, many of whom I don't know because it's expanded so widely and shifted now to all channels, not only physiology and the study of mechanism as I'm studying, but also study of consequence. So, as you know, a lot of aging studies today are, why do we get cancer? Why do we get Alzheimer's disease? Why do we get these age-related diseases? So those are consequential. Those studies of aging are consequential. My focus is primarily basic. Why do we get old? And I think that it's caught my attention because I figured if we can answer that question and regulate the rate of aging, then we've made a significant contribution to medicine for the reasons I just stated.
I suppose that if you tie that to genetic research on the likelihood or incidence of disease in an individual, in other words, if you see that somebody's prone to Alzheimer's and so on, or different things that are age-related in their process of development, and you can also then slow down the aging rate, you not only can increase the period of time for treatment, as you said, but you can also target it more carefully, and you can also then maybe in the future manipulate the genes to avoid that future problem entirely. So I can see that this is tied to genetic analysis for disease purposes, or you know.
That's exactly right. If you look at diseases like Parkinson's or Huntington's, or you know, as we just said, Alzheimer's, or even in cases of these kids that have accelerated aging, this progeria, if there were some way that we could actually regulate their development, slow it down, we might be able to better understand how to treat it. Because the cause of progeria chromosomes and the genes related to progeria are already identified. But manipulation of those doesn't seem to affect the rate of progression of the disease. However, if we could regulate the rate of normal aging, perhaps then we'd have a bigger window to intervene in not only that problem, but more typical ones, cancer, for example, and other things that need time, or that develop and get worse with time. If we could slow time of the body, we've made a significant contribution to medicine.
Well, obviously, everyone has always been interested in staying younger longer, and certainly the baby boom has been in the vanguard of wanting to stay adolescent into their 30s and as young as possible. What's the catchword? The 70 is the new 50 or whatever, you know. So I mean, I'm sure that if you begin to make breakthroughs in unlocking the keys to aging, you can get a lot of financial support if that becomes something that's really realistic and is publicized well enough. I imagine that the financial support from not only agencies but foundations and so on would roll in.
Well, that fortunately now that is true. But the fact is, it's not necessary because the interest in this syndrome. The initial trust in my hypothesis is significant enough that people are willing to expend their own resources. Like I said, this great company in California who's doing all this genetic analysis for free. I mean, if you had to put out the money for that, it would cost quite a bit. So the scientific interest in people like myself and basic scientists and people involved in medicine are willing to bear the cost. For the understanding of the process. And then, of course, eventually that's going to turn into a big business, but that's not my or our current interest. We're just trying to get understanding of the process.
And normally, I know in the real world, pharmaceutical companies aren't interested in pursuing drug treatments or any sort of treatment for conditions that are extremely rare because they'll never get paid back for the millions of dollars, maybe even $1 billion it costs to get a new drug through the FDA and the whole clinical trials and testing process and so on. So a lot of those conditions are kind of orphans in a way, and I suspect this very much would be one of those, except for the connection to aging. So do you see pharmaceutical companies kind of sitting on the sidelines watching what you're doing with potential interest?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. As a matter of fact, there are interventions or drugs already being tried to treat conditions of aging, but not necessarily, not to do what we're doing,
right.
Trying to find the cause. There are antioxidants out there. There are the drugs developed to counteract the degenerative effects of aging. But those are the consequential treatments. Because don't forget, when you're doing aging research or aging studies for financial gain, you have to do something within a relatively easy period of time, and you've got to target something specifically. So there has to be some kind of thing that you're going to fix, okay? So if you have, a cancer, then you've got to get a drug to fight that cancer. And so aging, an ambiguous concept like aging, is not going to receive pharmaceutical attention until it becomes actually the target. Right now, the targets of pharmaceutical interest are the diseases of aging. The consequences of aging.
Sure.
So, yes, in answer to your question, there is a lot of money to be made there, but not yet in the level of scrutiny that we're doing because it's too open-ended, it's too ambiguous.
And I would imagine it would involve some sort of genetic engineering, which is still in its infancy, I think, right?
Well, it is, but we've come significantly far from when I was a student. Clearly now, we can sequence the whole human genome, and that's what we're doing with these girls. And that was an impossibility just how long ago? Not 2 decades ago. So the rate of development of this field is quite significant, and I believe that we will crack this nut. We will understand why we age, and we will be able to control it. But what's going to happen then is clearly there are going to be ethical issues and other political issues and all these other things that are going to come into play that are going to maybe modify utilization of that information.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We are talking with Dr. Richard Walker, who is studying a very rare condition in which children, in many respects, certainly the children who have this condition, don't age at anything like the normal rate. It's more like one-tenth the normal rate of aging. They have a variety of other conditions that complicate the picture, too. So he's one of the few people really focusing on this particular condition, and in fact, the one to first recognize it clinically and formally. So, Dr. Walker, what comes next in your pursuit of answers in this area?
Well, right now our search continues of the modifications of the genome of these girls, because we possibly have overlooked some things. We're continuing to get new subjects and continuing to build a larger database. Clearly, there has to be a sufficient number of people involved so that we can see trends in, let's say, trends in genetic change that we can associate with a particular aspect of aging that we're looking at. You know, we're looking primarily at the rate of aging. So the mutations that we found so far, while we've identified them, their functions in the body, as many genes now have been identified, but we don't know really what their functions are yet, put the burden of us to actually try to understand, do these mutations relate to our search? So the easy part was, and continues to be, to find subjects and then to sequence their DNA and look at epigenetic factors that cause them to have this condition. Now, as I said, that's easy because what's coming up is we're doing another show on TLC that people will see about our current developments in our search. And so more families, I expect, will be contacting us for information about their daughters, if in fact this is a female situation, and it seems to be with a growing number. The hard part is, and the part that's going to take us longer time, is to try to understand these mutations as they relate to the clinical problem. Because as I just briefly mentioned, a lot of mutations are identified. We know what they are. But what they do, especially in concert with other genes, is still a mystery. So those analyses are underway and will continue probably well into the future.
Well, we are going to have to leave it there. This has been very interesting, but we're out of time. If people want to learn more and actually see some photos and even video of some of these children, you can Google Benjamin Button children, which, as Rich said, is not actually an accurate name for the condition, but it'll get you some stuff on the web. So Google Benjamin Button children. Dr. Richard Walker, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure, and I hope you brought some information about this interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, you did add a lot of, this is news to most people, so it's been very interesting. Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.